my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
The name of the show.
If the microphone still works.
Exactly. If anything still works here.
It's night shift, I guess.
Reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
How does it feel? Feels like times have changed.
How long has it been since you've slept?
I don't know. Fine. I never seem to get tired. But I know I haven't slept since this thing began.
I'm talking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I know.
me destroy you. Don't make me destroy you.
It seems like times have changed.
Night shift.
Invisible barriers. Keeps anyone from getting out. It's designed to keep me inside. It keeps everyone else in too.
I'm sorry.
Night shift again.
It only happens.
Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
The 70 billion people of Earth, where are they hiding?
Executive Order AUC-3423.
Listen to this, boys.
Night shift.
Mondays. Midnight.
Night shift.
You'll know where you are.
Night shift. It's
when
favorite show.
You begin to feel it.
Night shift.
It's invisible.
Night shift.
You can feel it.
Night shift.
It happens.
Yes. Night shift.
It's all around you.
Yes, it's right about now, not later. Cause we can wait and set sail. Or hey, the dream ship navigators. Like Jonah in the way where the soul investigates. Both sides of the equator. Back and forth like spoons through the force of the raiders. We don't waver. We got to get it on like funky body shoppers. Now guess who is coming to suffer? Not the dreadlocks, the fly bomb deluxe on the up and ups. Yes, yes, the non-stoppers with the steady flux. Traveling more miles than migratory ducks. You bet it's not the bucks that'll make us run amok. We can never get stuck whining. Life sucks and our sucks. We don't give a hard place in the rock. Our house is in our pockets and no doors locked. And if you're not, there's an answer. So don't you just stand there. Come in and let us rock. Want y'all from the top to the last living drop. Yes, yes, Lamont, they're on combo. They can't test them, and we blow them down like Lester Young. See, God bless them, and we mad explosive spontaneity. A bubbling up constantly like a mile a minute. And movement is the way, and we take it to the limit. Hyperactive, we hold the world captive by the spirit, the soul flow. We going all up in it, stepping out from the dust and the dirt. Love is the urge, and we know what it's worth. Meanwhile, we keep warm, wearing several shirts with the smell of fresh sweat from the flesh of the earth. Earth.
night shift. I like my night shift. Just like this.
How long has it been since you've slept?
I don't know. Fine. I never seem to get tired. But I know I haven't slept since this thing began. Consuelo, they're not human.
Night shift.
Midnight.
Night shift.
Till 2 a.m.
Night shift. For professional use only. Night shift. It's your favorite show.
I'm talking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I know.
Now, where are my people?
Feels like times have changed, 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 changed,
Saunders.
Mike Sargent.
You know, it's interesting. I recently on eBay, I bought some DATs and some DAT machines. I bought, like, you know, that DAT machine like I always wanted, that portable DAT, that top-of-the-line Sony, the last one they made, the 10th anniversary one, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes! And, you know, now they're like, people have them. They sat in the studio. They're brand new. They sat in a store in the back somewhere so you can get them with, for a song. Anyway, and so I have a bazillion DAT tapes. Chris, are you there?
Oh, I'm thinking that we're
so you can
doing
with
a show from 20 years ago
that.
For some reason.
Exactly.
I swear to God, I thought I was calling into like a time warp.
Exactly.
Like, Byron just bought a DAT machine like yesterday, and it's 1996.
Exactly. So I have to say, I found all these old shows, old tapes, things. I'm going to play some. Now I can bring back the Rare Weirdness.
Ooh,
because now
we haven't done the Rare Weirdness in a long time.
Plenty Rare Weirdness.
Yes, sir. So you have a collection of DATs.
More than you could possibly imagine.
Goodness.
More than you could possibly imagine. I have DATs. I even have, you know, DAT shelving. Like when they made DAT shelving and DAT units, like DAT storage, I have DAT storage units designed for the DAT.
For the DAT.
And for those who are listening who were not, you know, really collecting electronic equipment in the late 20th century, DAT was something called digital audio tape.
Yeah.
For those a certain age will know what that is. Digital audio tape is something that came out. It is the precursor to today's CD and everything else, the digital MP3s, all that. Just zeros and ones.
Revolutionized the tape.
What it did is, it made amazing high frequency sound,
yes.
Not only small, portable, but, you know,
it was digital.
You know, perfect reproduction.
Yes.
Anyway, so digital tape, but it's still moving parts.
Mm.
So it was doomed, you know, just like Blu-ray and all the other stuff is doomed to one day, you know, it's, you know, planned obsolescence.
Yes.
So, point being, all these DATs. DAT is digital audio tape. It came out. It did well for quite some time, but then it really became a staple of the professional recording industry. And so, like, for instance, here at the professional radio station WBAI, we have a DAT machine. So I can actually play DATs.
Mm-hmm.
Any recording studio would have a DAT. It is how you make a digital master, literally.
Yes.
That's just dubbed, and there's your master. You're walking around with your tiny master. Chris, did I leave anything out?
Nope.
There it is.
I remember the transition.
You remember the transition?
Yes.
Yes.
It was going from,
yes,
you know, Ampex tapes to
Ampex tapes.
Yeah, I mean, the one we had in the studio, it's funny, because
yes.
I've got a Panasonic
Maxell
DAT machine, and they were around $2,000 for a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Please.
And that's what you had to pay just to have one.
Please.
Just a quick sad note, Joe Frazier has passed away.
Frazier, the fighter?
Smokin' Joe Frazier.
Really?
He was awesome.
Died this evening after battling liver cancer. So
right.
All our love and positiveness goes out to the great
and positive
Joe Frazier and his family.
Smokin' Joe Frazier. He was awesome, dude.
Yes.
But he took that punch that George Foreman lifted him off his feet.
Never was the same.
Never
after
was
that.
The same.
Sad.
I mean, the Thriller in Manila was kind of a.
You a big fight fan?
Oh yes, absolutely.
You know, we're all getting old, man, because you know, people that are heroes are starting to pass.
Yes, they are.
Oh, Mike, this is so funny.
Yes, it is. It's like it. I know this.
Need to turn up your radios if you're at home.
Yes, this is DAT time.
This was, you know,
yes,
the theme.
The theme, yes, this was the theme. Oh my goodness.
20 years ago, Byron.
Stop it. I keep asking you every year, when? When? When, Mike?
All right. Before I get lost in that groove there for a second, I do want to say that I have quite an interesting show planned for you. I have Life is Like Science Fiction Bar, and you can read off a few headlines there. Just
man
for those.
Claims prostitute turned into donkey
that's
overnight.
Right. That's right, right here. And Byron, I have all kinds of stories. The frog killer disease.
Yeah. Oh, stop.
Okay, that's wiping out all the frogs around the planet. Do you know about it?
Yes, I've heard.
Well, then there it is.
And NASA examines tractor beams for sample
tractor beams, Byron.
Yes, tractor beams.
Has life become science fiction, or is it just still like military robots can leave operators at home?
Exactly.
Military robots. Just that term right there says it all. If that's not
science
fiction.
Did we upload the link this year?
What's that?
Didn't we upload the link this year?
Skynet is live. Skynet. All right, how about a giant.
Aware.
Giant rogue python swallows deer whole.
I saw that.
Whole.
Yeah. I saw that.
You know, if you get hungry, there's nothing you can't eat.
I saw that.
Think about that. And it's interesting what's happened as we encroach upon the life and the wildlands of all the Earth's animals and kill. Did you read about like just recently, like the last white buffalo rhino. It was found killed by poachers and its horn missing. A certain breed of rhino. It's over.
I thought you were going to say the last white man was.
Yeah, you know, the last white man. That's
the last white man was found. This thing now.
Speaking of
yes,
Cain being toast.
How did that?
I don't know. I just threw that in there. I'll leave that alone. I'll come back to it later.
Can I just talk for like 5 seconds about my week?
Yeah, go for it.
Wait, can I tell? Can I give the before you give out your?
You're not even going to ask me.
No, I'll ask you your week. I had an incredible week last week.
All right.
Well, we'll talk about everybody's week.
Can I give out the contents of the show? We have a theme for today.
We have content. We have content.
Okay.
I have two interviews for you.
Uh oh.
Yes, I interviewed Dennis Farina.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Dennis Farina.
That must have been fun.
It was fun. And so I have an interview with Dennis Farina. He's got a new movie out called The Last Rites of Joe May.
Yeah.
Where he really gives a phenomenal look. Byron's looking at the ad right now.
Yes.
It's a great performance he gives. Okay. It's a good story, good film, well done. He's very good in it. Then I have a director you need to know about. There's a film, Byron.
Yes.
With a title that I thought, oh, God, you know, sounds so B-movie. It's called Elite Squad, The Enemy Within. And I thought, you know, whatever. So they sent it to me. It's in Portuguese, Byron. It takes place. It's a Brazilian film. Excellent.
Really?
One of the best films I've seen this year. I'm telling you, good, like so good. All right, corruption, police, real drama, real stories, really, really, really good twists. Original. This is not. They're not making these films in America right now. Okay.
Ooh.
In the '70s, they did. All right.
Yeah.
That good. And then I read up on him.
Mm-hmm.
He is the director-writer, okay, because he wrote and directed this. His name is Jose Padilla,
okay.
He is the new director-writer for the RoboCop reboot.
Uh-oh.
And now,
uh-oh,
Byron, and so we talked about that, too.
Uh-oh.
So I got the interview with Jose Padilla.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
I'm looking forward to this.
Now, Chris.
Yeah.
And life is like science fiction. And how was your week, Chris?
Well, one thing I just was reading that John Lennon's tooth sold for $31,000. That is life as much science fiction. I don't know how they were able to sell his tooth.
Yeah, I don't know. I had one extracted.
And it comes like with a dental authentification.
I don't know.
Yes,
but yeah, no.
How much did you get? $31,000?
$31,000 for John Lennon's tooth.
Like, I wonder, like, what kind of person buys John Lennon's tooth?
I'm not sure. Someone will have
body
to.
Parts, like. No. That could be a whole black market. They start exhuming celebrities.
You know, if you're famous, start saving your parts now.
That's right. You could start exhuming celebrities, Byron, okay? Exhume them and then start selling the parts on eBay. It could be a whole plot. Underground business. Are you with it? Like, it could be one of those movies, like a Judd Apatow film.
Well, somebody is taking that one step further recently.
Recently.
A serial killer is collecting thumbs, fingers.
I have a story too.
Reading about that?
No, but I do have a story that... Okay, I'll just read the title of the story to you, Byron.
Yes.
And this should say it. No, I'll let you read the title.
All right.
Okay? Just you can read the title of this story here, Byron.
Aha! Whoa! Sour toe cocktail. Father and son bond over drinking dead man's toe. Uh-uh. That's not a martini.
You know, I don't know.
I don't think so. Sour
All right,
toe
so Chris,
cocktail.
Yep. Your week. You want to tell
My
me about
so,
your week?
You know, I think we talked about it briefly about a month ago that Chick Corea, the famous legendary piano player, Chick Corea, is pretty much sitting in house at Blue Note until the 27th of this month.
I like
and,
Chick Corea.
Different nights he's playing with different people.
Yes.
So
I did this t-shirt.
One night he did, or two nights they were playing, but one night I got to spend this week was with Return to Forever, Unplugged. Without Al Di Meola, with Frank Gabali, who was playing part of that new RTF. And that was just probably one of the most amazing shows that I've seen, as I had told you. It was just phenomenal. And then on Saturday night, it was the John McLaughlin version with Chick Corea.
Yes.
And there's a drummer called Brian Blade, who was probably one of the most phenomenal drummers that I've seen in a long time that was playing old school, like he was resurrecting the spirit of Tony Williams, so to speak. Just going to be playing for the rest of the month of the 27th. I'll be going to a couple of more of his shows. And he just, you know, Saturday night, just sit there for half an hour and Chick.
Why don't you give out the dates that you're going so people can look for you?
I'll be there the last night of Chick's show, both shows, which will be the 27th of November, which will be the Chick Corea Electric Band. And then this Saturday night with Gary Burton. The only show I'm not going to see is one with Herbie Hancock, which I can't, but I really wanted to see Chick and Herbie play together. I've only seen Herbie play once, and that would have been interesting. But Chick was just so amazing. It's so amazing to hang out with him, and he is, for anyone out there, if you want to just, if there's any, there's always standing room seats at the Blue Note.
Blue Note,
yes. He is a legend. He's celebrating his 70th birthday, and everything that he is about is inspiration and love and beauty, and he is a consummate, if not one of the most phenomenal keyboard players that has raised us in music. And,
very true.
You know, so for anyone out there, if you come down to look for me, just wave or just scream out like, you know, Night Shift, and I will stand up and say, you know, I'm just kidding. But, if you're down there, that'd be really fun. But yes, that was, and I know Byron had some incredible night at the Apollo.
Did. I sure did.
Yes.
At the Apollo, the Paradise Theater. I did five shows last week, five different boroughs. The Apollo Theater was incredible. 70th birthday in celebration of George Clinton with Ray Chu live playing as the house band. Mm. I mean, we had Nona Hendrix, Paul Schaefer. I mean, Paul Schaefer got off, okay? I mean, he played funk. Funk to the line, baby. Paul Schaefer, Fab Five.
Funk to the line?
Funk to the line. I sure did. Fab Five Freddy.
What era is that from?
Oh, you just had to be there.
Yeah, you had to be there to Funk to the line, Mike. Obviously, you don't know what Funk to the line means.
Fab Five Freddy, Nona Hendrix, Ty Tribbett, Bernie Worrell.
What was he saying, jokes?
No, Bernie Worrell was playing
no,
serious funk, man. Bootsy Collins.
Wow.
Sheila E. was...
Was Carlos Santana there?
No, Carlos wasn't there, but I mean, everybody else was there. Even Lady Gaga was in the audience. You know, we spotted her. But it was a who's who on stage. It was a tribute to George Clinton. It was awesome. It was a once-in-a-lifetime event. That was just one of the five concerts that I did. And then at the Paradise on that Friday, I had Dougie Fresh, Marley Marl, Kango Kid, Roxanne Shanté, Styles P, DJ Red Alert. I mean, it was an incredible boom, birth of the boom. I mean, loud as you can make it at the Paradise Theater in the Bronx. I had a show, Mike, at the Frank Sinatra School of the Arts, a Glee type of show. I sent you the pictures. Chris, did you see the pictures that I sent you? Yes.
It was amazing.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Even Cornel West was up on stage dancing with Bootsy and the rest of the crew.
You know when I see you grooving on stuff, Byron,
man.
Pictures and stuff, I just smile. I smile externally and I smile internally, always for you.
Man. Thank you, man.
I know that because I know that it's like me being there. I know that just moments like this, in our lives.
Yeah,
beautiful thing, man.
It was really. And then during the snowstorm on Saturday, I had a gospel show in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy with Valerie Boyd, Richard Smallwood, and Hezekiah Walker and his choir. And I mean, they raised the roof. Spirit was in that church, let me tell you. But it was an amazing week. I was bone tired at the end because that Sunday after the snowstorm, we were at Snug Harbor with a Halloween extravaganza. And it was a lot of fun.
It sounds like a real cozy place. Yeah. I was at Snug Harbor.
Snug Harbor, baby. But it was an amazing week. We were raising money for the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, which was very, very important. The message was stop the guns, stop the violence. And it was an incredible journey and incredible music history. And like yourself, I'm looking at the Blue Note ad with Chick Corea, and I remember Return to Forever Unplugged. I mean, my goodness, Chick Corea is like awesome, dude.
Yeah, I've known them all for years, and it's just, even Lenny and Stanley and all them were just ripping it up. I mean, the moment they were playing the other night together, they were just, I saw both sets. They played two nights, and I got to go one night for both sets, and they didn't repeat one song in both sets.
Wow!
He's
got a canon of music.
I mean, the Return of Forever, when they start playing
with Stanley Clark,
Lenny
White,
it was Unplugged. Yes. It was just like they could just tear it up, and Blue Note seats about 200 people, so it's an intimate.
Like, I know, isn't it nice when you're in that kind of... Yeah, it's really nice when you're in that club and you're just there.
And I know them and get to hang out with it, but they're so gracious. I mean, you could have gone up and see Chick, and he was taking time to talk to everyone who wanted to see him and, do pictures and autographs or whatever. And it's just beautiful that these musicians, not allow themselves, but are available to the public to right there. And if you wanted anyone out there wanted to go down and meet Chick, if you can get in there to see any of these shows or buy tickets for any of the shows.
You see all these people going down like, hey, Chris, can we meet your Chick? Chris, can we?
The Blue Note packs, though.
It's been wonderful.
Is, yeah.
And maybe Mike will do it. We'll just be with Chick because he's down for that. So maybe we'll have the honor to be able to do that. So everyone can hear Chick here.
Because tonight through the 10th, he has Bobby McFerrin.
Yes.
Come on, Chick Corea and Bobby McFerrin.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Actually, and Bobby usually, I was talking to one of Chick's, assistant guys that works for him, a guy named Andrew, and he was telling me that Bobby usually splits. But he was actually meeting everyone as well.
Wow.
Bobby never usually hangs around, so to speak.
And
Elvis usually leaves the house with him, but because it was Chick's birthday and everything. And Chick's wife, Gail Moran, got up and sang with Return to Forever.
Wow.
That was incredible.
Wow.
And she actually, we didn't see that, but on last night, Sunday night, according to, she supposedly was rehearsed with McLaughlin and would have sang.
Right.
He played in the John McLaughlin band as well as Chick Corea band. So she rehearsed and I think they did a song last night. I haven't heard back what it was, but I know that Gail, because I saw Gail and she said that they were going to be doing one song from old Mahavishnu.
And on the 11th through the 13th, Chick Corea and Gary Burton are playing.
Gary Burton, I'll be there Saturday night. Yeah, that's going to be incredible.
Know it.
Oh, it's just, I'm so excited.
Giants of music.
Oh, I mean, for anyone out there, you know what's amazing about the Blue Note is it is a magnet, even today, for a lot of people from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
I met somebody from Israel that was just in for like about a week in New York, and they didn't even know who Chick Corea was, but they just wanted to see a jazz band.
And they got to see
it.
No, I'm saying.
Is that wild?
Oh, it's too wild.
So I met, and there were two other guys from France that were sitting at our table. So I'm talking to these guys. It was like the international, conference of different people from different countries coming just because they just want to hear jazz in New York.
Well, that's a great place to hear it. And I mean,
not knowing who the artist is, but they just know that the Blue Note's going to have someone incredible. So yeah, Chick Corea, all my love goes to him and his 70th birthday and you know, his music and just being able to just be accessible and out there and doing it at 70, which is 70 still young for all of us.
70 still young.
I know Mike had an incredible week. Where did Mike go?
Yeah, Mike, tell us about
your incredible week.
I'm going to play some of it to you.
Okay.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking with actor Dennis Farina, who's in a new film called The Last Rites of Joe May. Dennis, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So let me ask you a question. You know, you've always sort of fascinated me in terms of, you know, what your background was, what you did before you were an actor, and you've probably been asked this a lot, but during the time that you were a policeman, I believe for 18 years in Chicago, was acting something that you thought about? Was it something that you fell into? How did you end up being an actor?
Oh, I just fell into it. It was nothing I thought about doing. It was happenstance. I was in the right place at the right time. I met Michael Mann and kind of went from there.
And were you always...
talking to you.
What's that? And now you're talking to me. And were you always a natural storyteller?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm really bad at describing what I am. I don't mean to be shallow, but I'm just not very good at that. But I always enjoyed the movies. As a kid, it was our primary source of entertainment. Television really wasn't prevalent. And, going to the movies was a really good economical entertainment.
Sure. And for you now, you've worked with a lot of great actors, a lot of great directors. At this stage of your career, what are you the most proud of in terms of what you've done, or do you not look back and you just look forward as to what the next thing is?
Well, a little bit of both. And I think everybody that I know that's an actor or actress always thinks that what they're doing at the time is their favorite. I can say I thoroughly enjoyed doing Joe May. I just had a great time doing it. I thought it was a really good script and directed really well, I think. But then I look back and I always had a good time. I enjoyed doing Snatch. I loved doing Get Shorty, Midnight Run. I always had a nice time doing these movies, and I've always been very fortunate with working with fellow actors and really talented directors.
Well, one of the qualities that you have, again, perhaps you've been told this a lot, you're very, very watchable. Even when you're playing a bad guy, you're sort of that bad guy you love to hate. Are you able to watch yourself on screen? Do you have any sense of how you come across?
I'm very reluctant to watch myself on screen. I rarely have done it. I mean, I've seen pieces of things because I had to go in and dub them, but I rarely see anything that I've done. I know people could do that, and they can learn from it, they say, but I do that and just come away very doubtful about everything that I did. You know, why did I do that? You know, that looked horrible and the clothes looked bad. I myself up, so I avoid those kinds of situations if I can.
You're always very natural seeming on screen. I always believe you as the character you're playing. And in Joe May, I agree with you. I thought it was a great script. I thought it had a lot to say about a lot of things, but it didn't hit you over the head with it. What were the things about it that made you say, you know, I want to do this?
Well, the first thing that interested me, I thought it was interesting to me that when he left the hospital, he knew that no one would be waiting for him. And there was no one. There was no wife, there was no son, there was no friend. And he goes right back to the corner bar where, you know, his life really is. And everybody thinks he's dead. You know, so who he thought he was important to, he really wasn't. He was meaningless to them. And his life died in more ways than one. And people gave things away. His bank account was down. His car was gone. His apartment was gone. His whole life was taken from him. But now, you know, now he starts to build up again. Or at least he wants to. You know, I think in a way he's the eternal optimist that none of this stuff is going to keep him down.
Right.
You know, he's definitely a fish out of water.
Mm-hmm.
And time has certainly passed him by. And I think that's why when he goes to see his friend at the retirement home, he can't believe that he's retiring. And he can't believe that he's just playing cards in there, that he's got to have some kind of scheme, scam or something going on in the retirement home. And when Lenny tells him to go to Florida, you know, he tells him, you know, Florida's not for me. I don't want to do that. You know, he still thinks he's viable and that he can do something, be worth something.
Well, essentially, he's right.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Have you known a lot of Joe Mays? Was there anybody you patterned after, or did you kind of infuse him with some of who you might be in that situation?
Well, not consciously. You know, I've known a few Joe Mays. I still know a few Joe Mays. Not consciously. And I have to say that it was all right there on the page.
Mm.
When I read it, I understood right away what Joe Maggio was getting to. What the character was. I wish I could say that I created him wholly and that he was all mine and, you know, it came out of my mind. But it really didn't. It came out of the writings of Joe Maggio.
Tell me a little bit about maybe your approach to acting, because, again, you don't seem like the kind of guy that went to method or any of that. You just seem like, you know, you're a natural born actor. So tell me a little about your method and working with a little girl.
Working with a little girl was terrific. Meredith. As was Jamie Allman. Both just wonderful to be around. And Meredith was as professional and as nice and funny and adorable as any little girl could be. She was just wonderful to be around. And Jamie, I thought, really found a character of Jenny. You know, Jenny, I'm afraid, excuse me, can almost be termed a professional victim.
Yeah.
You know, she just, one of those people who just can't get out of doing what she does, you know.
Can't get out of her own way.
Yeah, exactly right, exactly right. And and with me, it's pretty simple. You know, if I read something and I like it, I think people involved are interesting people as far as directors and actors are concerned, and they want to hire me. That's pretty much my criteria.
Well, I thought it was very well played, well written, well done, and again, it shows me what a great range you have. I mean, I've seen movies where I'm afraid of you, and this is one of the few times where I really was rooting for your character. I wanted your character to sort of wake up a little bit too. You really come to care about this person, which I don't think is an easy thing to do. You come to care about this man who tries not to care too much about anybody or anything.
Yeah, you know, he's selfish in a way, but I think because of survival, you know, I think he needs to survive. At the same time, I do think he has a heart, and I think he does realize that he's made some mistakes. And I think that Jenny and Angela are finally the vehicles that are going to give him some kind of a redemption, in that his life really wasn't worthless.
What's your preferred way of working and working out what a character does? Or do you just go with however the director wants?
Well, a little bit of both. I usually think, anyway, that the first takes are usually the best, because I think they're less unencumbered. But then I can argue that once you do it and you get to know the character a little better, and your conversations with the director become more that you both agree with what the character is, I think sometimes the more you do it, the more relaxed you come into that character, and the more relaxed you can be in further takes.
Well, you definitely are an actor who has just never stopped working. And if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a little bit about, there's a series that I've read about that you've got coming up that you, Dustin Hoffman, Nick Nolte, Gary Stevens, a bunch of people are in, called Luck. And it sounds definitely fascinating. And I'm curious, to get the level of talent, including yourself, what is it, do you think, that would draw that level of talent to TV, because in the last 10-15 years, TV is really not one of those things you do if you can't get work. There's a lot of great things you can do on TV.
Well, I don't want to sound like a pitch man for HBO, but I think particularly for HBO, I mean, I watch it as a matter of course, even before I was involved with them all. I did work with them once before, but if you get phone calls from David Milch and Michael Mann, and you get the scripts that we were getting, you know, the decision is pretty much made for you.
Okay, I hear you. If Joe May were a friend of yours, how would you describe him?
I think Joe, and it's a pretty good question, I think Joe is a lovable rogue whose time has come and gone.
Fun track, this music here. This is such a fun track. It's a score to Tower Heist, and it should give you an indication of just how much fun the film is. It gets itself, and you get it. It's fun. It's fun. This is what, in my opinion, it's what Ratner does best. But you can see it's like, you get it. That whole, like, almost Lalo Schifrin.
Doing comedy is not
action comedy, especially action
comedy. Yeah,
I like the Rush Hour movies. I have no problem with them.
Gotta be clever.
They're all good.
They are what they are.
They're fun.
They gotta be clever and
that's
fun.
That's right. I will say, I don't really like his serious films. I was not impressed. I didn't think that much of X-Men 3. I thought that was a bit of a mess. And I didn't think that much of his version of, Manhunter, essentially, or Red, whatchamacallit.
No.
I didn't think much of that at all. But I think this is what he does best, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought particularly Eddie Murphy, who came on as a producer in this, and who doesn't do that much, you know, especially doesn't do that much adult. Like he'll do like a kid's film or whatever, but he doesn't really do that much adult comedy anymore. And he was like the cutting edge of adult comedy for a long time. You know what I'm saying?
So you say this movie is bringing Eddie back in the sense of a comedian?
I'm saying that now. I'm putting that out there to say contextually, how many great roles are there for black comedians out there? I mean, you know, how many great roles are there? So I'm just saying.
He's been profiled as a type that does a movie like 48 Hours.
Right? Well, he started out like that. I mean, he's broadened himself.
And it's good comedy.
But again, how many great scripts are there for black, you know, who's his successor? All right. So the point I'm making is that, so there's not that much out there for him. And he always risks, I think, repeating himself. So a role like this where he plays, you know, the criminal, you know, and he does it in his Eddie Murphy way, and it's funny. It maintains a good balance. It's consistently funny. It doesn't. There are points where you go, uh-oh, I've seen this before, but they don't do what they did before. And you know what I'm saying? Again, for him to play a criminal, period, in a comedy. Black comedian playing a black criminal in a comedy.
That's been done before.
Exactly. It's like how many times
has
that
been
done?
Yeah, how many more times?
So I say that to say that in Lesser, and I give Brad Ratner credit because in Lesser Hands, it would have come off again and gotten scathing reviews and Eddie Murphy appears in a shadow of his form. You know, it would have been that kind of, you know how critics are. They're snarky as hell. So, and I know them. I know a lot of snarky critics.
You don't know any.
I know
are they snarky?
They're snarky, babe.
Snarky. Now, Mike knows the
better
great
watch
critics
out.
Like
they're snarky.
Like Katie Rich, what a great critic.
Katie Rich, she's going to be in Florida.
She's going to be in Florida.
She's going to be in Florida. I'll be in Florida this weekend for the. Huh? You know what I'm going to Florida for, Byron? They're flying me out for the release of the DVD of the last Harry Potter and the opening of the Harry Potter Wizarding World theme park opening gala.
So when you're sitting there at the bar having a drink, Mike,
having a magic
Mike, when
cocktail.
You're sitting there having a drink with Katie Rich, who we'll have on the show at some point.
Kevin Scott's going to come down.
Excuse me.
What? No, Kevin Scott's
coming. Excuse me. What?
I'm so glad you invited me. Thank you very much.
Well, no, he paid for his own ticket.
I would have paid for my own ticket.
You still can.
Do you need a chaperone?
Joe did the reservation. All right, so you are Tuntle Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5.
You need a chaperone to go with
we
you.
Just heard an interview with Dennis Farina, who is starring a new film called The Last Rites of Joe May. We were just talking about, we're listening to the soundtrack of a film right now called Tower Heist, which is very good, and it's by Christoph Beck, who I've interviewed as well, good composer, and it's a really fun score. That's the one thing I could tell you. I also have an interview, like I said, coming up later with Jose Padilla, and you'll really enjoy it, Byron. It's because he's really clearly very political, and he's a documentary filmmaker. He was a documentary filmmaker before he started doing narrative films.
Yeah.
So he does a lot of research, and when you watch the film, you are learning as you watch. It's very good. Spock!
Are you okay?
No, it's a reaction.
It's a reaction to something.
Right on cue.
The music.
Right on cue.
Yes.
Right on cue.
She comes in.
Right on cue.
Hello.
Oh!
It's Elena.
In a tight sweater.
Oh!
A Quinn Martin production. So, Elena, there's some stories there for you. Byron, you want to give the first story?
All right.
After you give the first story, then I will give the theme.
We do have a theme.
Yes, we do.
Oh, a theme.
Yes, we do. And we have theme, we have reviews, we have interviews.
You know, in a weird headline, before you do that, just in a weird headline, because I could just imagine what this must have been like driving, because I drive a lot over the Tappan Zee Bridge and stuff. Someone, was protesting today, so they... pulled their van over to the side of the road and then dropped down 65 feet and hung for like 3 hours on the Tappan Zee Bridge this afternoon. And I could just imagine what the nightmare that everybody with the traffic stopped for miles, absolute miles in both directions, all the way up and all the way down today must have been like. And then he dropped into the water and then was arrested. And he was protesting.
Yeah. That's a protest?
Now, he was protesting being fired. He was a government worker. So I hope that he can get his issues resolved. But in some cases, I don't know.
Protest. Interesting.
You know, it's an interesting way of protesting. I'm not sure if there's a better way, but...
Well, you know what? But here's what's interesting. We're in this time now where we'll see all kinds of interesting ways, protest stunts.
Yes.
I predict protest stunts, Byron. I predict a rash of them.
You might be
this
right.
is my prediction. Profit or crackpot.
What do you think about that, Byron, about what Mike's saying?
As
here?
A staged event, just because it has the potential for someone wanting to film it as the
That's,
making
it's
of.
It's the world we live in. Mm. That was the kind of world. That
you know what, Mike? There is the next documentary.
Yes.
Well, the potential for it to be staged as a production is always there. But remember, the revolution will not be televised.
You know, the Tony Bates had a great line. He was down at the protest. He said, the revolution smells funny.
That's good.
He's right.
You have a story?
Okay, let's get kick this off with some cocktails. Sour toe cocktail. Father and son bond over drinking dead man's toe. Now, there's a video of this.
Arg. Be drinking dead man's toes.
Yes, arg. Fathers arg. And sons traditionally bond over a shared experience. Hunting, fishing, playing catch. But it's highly unusual for the familial moment.
The familial moment?
Yes, to
the familial.
Are you talking about the familial moment?
Yes, of course. To involve sucking on a dead man's toes.
Mm.
Excuse me.
It could be a Bob Dylan song. Sucking on a.
That's how it works for Ron and Matt Francell.
Did they say which toe?
Yes, before Matt went off to college at University of Nebraska in 2007, the pair decided to take a road trip from San Antonio, Texas to Alaska. It was a trip six
years. Let's drive across country,
That's
son,
right.
and suck some
big toe.
Suck some toe.
Some toe.
It was a trip 6 years in the making, and the experience inspired Francell to write the Sour Toe Cocktail Club. You see, the Yukon Odyssey.
The what?
The Sour Toe Cocktail Club. You see, the Yukon Odyssey of a father and a son in search of a mummified toe. And everything else.
In search of a mummified toe.
Yes. And everything else. That's the name of their project. This is,
what are they, documentary filmmakers?
Yeah. I had this overwhelming urge to spend time with my son, Ron Francell, told the Huffington Post. And this idea popped up during a summer vacation when Matt was 13 and heard about the Sour Toe Cocktail. Ah, yes, the Sour Toe Cocktail, gruesomely famous beverage served only in one place in all of the world. In Dawson City, a town 300 miles from Arctic Circle in Canada's Yukon Territory. Now, this creepy cocktail is a sort of any type of hard alcohol served in a glass with a dehydrated human toe mummified in salt.
With a dehydrated
of legend.
How come they don't even talk about where the toe comes from?
I'm starting to get sick right now.
As the story goes,
I really am.
A man known as Captain Dick Stevenson started this tradition in 1973.
Captain Dick? Captain Dick?
He is said to have discovered the original toe in a cabin that he purchased, which had previously belonged to a trapper. Who led his lost big
trapper.
Yes,
that's something to put on your resume.
Who had lost his big
trapper.
He had lost his...
What other skills do you have?
He had lost his
I'm a trapper.
Toe to frostbite.
What'd you say?
Is this sponsored by Dr. Scholl's?
He lost his toe to frostbite, and he put it in a jar.
And it showed
this
up...
This is the origin of the big... The sour
who,
toe
who,
cocktail.
The father did?
No, this is what this happened. This is how they created this drink.
Okay, go ahead. I don't know if I want you to continue, but continue.
According to the rules, the rusty toe must touch the lips before lips during the drink's consumption for the drinker to earn the distinction of being a true sour toe.
Listen, if my lips touch the liquid that the toe is floating in, I consider myself to be brave upon brave.
This goes beyond the worm in the tequila bottle. This is the toe in your drink.
You know, I dip the Q-tip in it and then, like, maybe dart my tongue at it.
I want to know who started it. These people started this stupid tradition. Now, see, other toes have since been donated.
Donate toes?
Yes, and are,
well, if they buy John Lennon's tooth,
and they are
I guess they'll donate toes.
And pickling salt when not being slurped.
Do you think the nails are clean?
There's a whole jar of toes, y'all. Yes! Pickled toe jar. Saloon officials say...
That's a good name for a band, though.
Saloon officials say the high alcohol content in the whiskey, vodka, and other booze keeps the toes sterile, despite being in the mouth.
Keeps the toes sterile.
Despite being in
that
the mouth.
That is what you call, you know,
of as many
justification.
As a few dozen people on a given night. Wait a minute, they're doing this on any given night? Oh my goodness. I can't believe people are doing this, Mike.
Then what happens to the toe?
It sits there.
It's
sterile. It's sterile alcoholic liquid.
It's like a prehistoric olive.
These fools.
Do you get to take it home for a souvenir?
No, you don't. You don't. You get to. You drink it and let it touch your lips, and then you throw it back in for next week or the next night. Is that what? Basically, is that the deal?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Okay.
It's a recyclable toe.
Basically.
It's a stinky toe.
It's a green toe.
Whatever
concept.
It is, it's stinky. It tastes stinky. It tastes like foot. And everybody knows here exactly what foot tastes like.
Well, what's phone number here?
212-209-2900.
You know what I'm saying?
It's like pickled feet. It's like pickled pig feet.
All right, here Brian.
It's got pickled toes.
Let me ask you a question.
If you want to find out what it would taste like, just suck a toe, and you'll be right in there.
That's nasty. Byron, I have a question
for
you.
What are you talking about?
Is there any food that you will just never eat? You just won't touch it. Like, you've never had it, and you'll never have it.
What? Suck a toe?
Yes.
He's pointing
to sour toe, baby.
Let me tell you something.
In general, I wouldn't know. Is there any food you refuse to even try?
Let me tell you something, man.
They have named it. I am not going to buy that product. I promise you. Sour toe.
Suck a toe.
Sour toe. Oh no. What about you, Elena? Is there any food that you refuse to even try?
I would suck a toe before I would eat squash.
No, forget squash. Really? So you've never had squash and you'll never try it?
They actually got a picture of the guy holding the toe, which he's about to suck on.
I know.
It's like eating wings.
You don't have a taste for sucking toe doesn't mean that some of us out there is not on that level. Okay.
And it's got. Excuse me. It's got a fingernail still on it.
Level is a figurative word here.
I don't want no dead toe.
Right, the toenail is still on there. We know the toenail will decompose. You ever see old men's feet with the fungus on it? No.
Yeah.
I can't see it. No, I don't want a sour toe.
Yeah, so you're walking around, Brian, looking at old man's foot.
Elena, you got a story. You got to give her one and then let Byron go back.
Sure.
What's the phone number you said, Byron?
212-209-2900. Pick up the phone. Give us a call. We're live tonight, y'all. I know y'all want to get on board. Come on.
We want to talk to you.
212-209-2900. Pick up the phone. Give us a call. We want to talk to you. We're back live. Night shift. It's your favorite show. So come on. Call in. Let us know how much you like it. We're ready to talk to you.
This is a suck your toe song.
All right, Elena, you have a story for us?
Yes. If you can't get it here in this life, you might get it after. Two ghosts caught having sex in front room. Two ghosts have been caught having sex in
two
the middle.
Two ghosts? Did you say ghosts?
Ghosts. In the middle of a living room, according to an Ohio resident, Diana Carlisle. The female ghost seemed to have grabbed her male partner by the ghoulies and decided to give him...
By the what?
The ghoulies. So use your imagination.
What
it's not a toe.
What are the ghoulies?
Imagination, please, Mike. And decided to give him a night he won't forget.
Stop.
That's according to Miss Carlisle.
Ghostly fellatio.
Who alleges she caught the ghost... quote unquote in the act. It looked like the ghost having sex, she told the Fox affiliate.
I see ghosts having sex in my living room. Oral sex, the fiends.
Well, it's not a toe. You can see the lady's high heel shoes. Miss Carla claims the phantoms had been having a scream
she's
of a time.
Inky.
For a while, but she was unable to document it until her 4-year-old granddaughter took the picture.
Took the picture of the ghost grabbing the ghoulies by the ghoulies.
Grabbing the ghoulies.
Yeah, grab my
the
ghoulies.
Ghost grabbing the ghoulies. And yeah, there's a photo. Can you describe the photo?
The photo is... okay.
Yeah, what does the photo look like? Somebody, well, I'd like to know what it looks like when you're grabbing the ghoulie.
It's kind of like a smoky, erected ghoulie.
Now so. That, my friend.
So again, who needs to suck toe when you
right,
can
when
have...
you can grab the ghoulie. My ghoulie.
You can
grab
have an ghoulie. Erect ghoulie.
Yeah, grab an erect ghoulie. Grab my ghoulie.
Then the snap supposedly shows the outline of a shoulder and an arm, which are above a white ghostly figure. If true, these spooky shenanigans will be a landmark in the study of paranormal activity.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Grab my ghoulie.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
I'd grab your ghoulie,
yeah.
Mike.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
And you too, Byron. And you too, Chris.
Grab my ghoulie.
Experts yeah. previously ghoulie. Unaware grab that spirit yeah. sex grab was possible.
Yeah. Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Grab my ghoulie.
Yeah.
Elena, you got distracted. You should continue with this story.
I know. I'm thinking how I would do this.
Mike and I are making a song. You're involved, Elena.
Okay. Good.
Make it too and grab our ghoulie.
I'd grab your ghoulie for a small fee. Investigator David Jones told the Huffington Post it was highly unlikely the ghosts were engaged in intercourse, but did
like,
admit...
That's not my locker.
He was curious about the house. He said this has never been reported before.
That's not David Jones' locker.
It would be interesting to know more about the house, however. I don't think that it has anything to do with sex. But I do wonder how long it's been going on. So...
How long have these ghosts been having sex in my house?
And do
so that's like the first time I've ever really heard of ghosts having sex. That's kind of original.
And do you need like a spiritual condom?
You know, you didn't see that Barbara Hershey movie.
Which one?
When she gets raped by a ghost.
No, I didn't see that one.
I think it's called The Entity.
Oh, really?
And they put, like, prosthetic breasts on her, so you see, like, the handprints on her breasts. That's the special effect.
Wow. Was it Dennis Hopper?
No, it was just some ghost.
Barbara You're a Hershey. Big Barbara Hershey fan, too, Mike.
I was. Pre-surgery Barbara Hershey.
Oh.
Hella, you're in the air. Myron, what's the phone number?
212-209-2900.
Byron reached out to whoever that caller was. They completely connected with Byron.
Byron, you have another story for us?
All right. This story is as bizarre as they get. Man claims prostitute turned into donkey overnight.
Coming in?
A man claims a prostitute turned into a donkey overnight.
That's Danny El Burro.
A man in Zimbabwe claims a prostitute he visited turned into a donkey overnight, and now he is seriously in love with the animal.
Oh.
Seriously in love. Now, as opposed to being seriously in love with the prostitute, he's seriously in love with the prostitute that turned into a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead, please, Brian. Please, tell me what more there could be to this story.
You don't really wanted me to read this story.
Elena's eyes were widened by that story. I noticed that they widened.
I've always wanted to be
Elena's
a donkey.
What? Her eyes? Or
I'm only going to read this.
No, not my.
I'm only going to read so much of this story. Creature of the night, a donkey, not the one that started life as a prostitute, to take note. You see, Sunday Mayo has been charged with bestiality, told a court in Zimbabwe on Monday that his donkey lover was in fact a hooker whose services he
donkey
procured
lover.
From a nightclub.
Now that's a song.
Donkey lover. Get out my way, you jackass!
I'm going to stop right there.
If you call in, I'll be your donkey lover.
And I want to really know who is the real...
Donkey lover?
No, ass.
Who is the real donkey lover?
Who is out there? Who is the real
who's
donkey
the real,
lover?
All I want to know is who is really the real ass...
Burre, puro amore.
El puro, el toro, el puro. Yes. El Danny El Burro.
Anyway, that's a sick story.
El Danny El Burro.
That's a sexy donkey.
El Burro, El Donkey, El Zello, El...
All right, here's one. Life is like science fiction.
Wait, you got to let Elena go.
Okay.
Elena. Give me a story.
Here's one. Russian man kept 29 dead bodies at home. Talking about mummified.
Yeah, I saw this story.
Yeah, Moscow. Russia's interior ministry said police have arrested a man who kept 29 mummified bodies at his apartment and dressed them up like dolls.
Mummified bodies and dressed them up like dolls.
Ministry spokesman said Monday that the suspect from the Volga River city...
How'd they catch him? All right, go ahead. I want to know how they caught him.
Dug up the bodies at several cemeteries in the region. The man, whose identity was withheld, dressed them up in clothes dug up from graves. They said the suspect is a historian who has authorized...
That was a good lawyer. He said, look, please, keep my name out of the papers. Please, for God's sake.
He said the arrest followed a police probe into the desecration of graves in the region, which answers your question, which was initially blamed...
What? Of who?
On extremist groups.
Desecration.
Desecration of graves. And she said, was that desecration that Elena said?
Desecration.
That was Elena version of desecration.
Yes. Russian Elena media reports quoted police as saying
Russian
that the man had only...
Did you say Russian meteor reports?
Reports.
Meteor?
No, media.
Oh.
Who quoted police as saying that the man only had selected the remains of young women for his grisly collection. And there's a picture.
Is there a picture?
So if you're going to take grisly remains, be selective.
Wait a minute.
Is that the lesson here?
Stop. What's with the
what does he get charged with? What's the charge?
Oh, you get charged with removing dead bodies. If you get, like, you get...
What did they say when they charge?
It's called the Boris Karloff. Boris Karloff.
The fact that he knows that?
Yes.
It's frightening.
What, the Boris Karloff law?
Yeah.
Yes, that's what it is. A statue. The Boris Karloff statue. Stealing bodies. Of course, nobody knows what it is. It used to be called the Peter Lorre one, but then it became the Boris Karloff one. You could have the Peter Lorre statue.
Good morning. It's nice to know you're having a good day.
Like, that wasn't funny? The Boris Karloff statue, that wasn't funny?
Chief, I got a question for you. Here's my question. Is there any food that you refuse to eat, you won't even try it?
Non-chief.
You know, Mike likes to engage the, you know, you
non-chief.
Like to...
Non-chief.
Yeah.
He almost answered. I almost got through.
You got through to him.
I almost got through. I almost broke through. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, you say what food you would never eat.
Yes, what food would you never eat? Like, you're just no way.
I would say never to that. Know why? Because people become cannibalism, you know.
In other words, you'd eat your brother.
I would say never.
You'd say never. So
there's
nothing.
We're talking about you. What would you never eat?
He said he'd even eat you, Chris, is what he's basically
saying. Me, myself, I wouldn't know, to be honest with you.
You yourself, you wouldn't know. I like how you qualify that. Like, well, me, myself, I wouldn't know about me.
Let's take a poll here. Let's see what this gentleman would say. Would you take a drink called the...
Elena, what's the phone number here?
212-209. The sour... 2900.
I don't think I would ever really eat monkey brain.
Would you, sir, would you take a sour toe cocktail?
What about monkey brain?
No. You're at the bar, and we want to know, would you take a sour toe cocktail? Suck on some toe.
Oh, I like this.
I would say yes. No problem. I would have no problem with that if that's the custom. Say it was the custom in some country to do that, and it would be an insult not do that. You know what I'm saying? That's why.
You're down with the dead toe, sour toe.
Yes, as long as they pay for your ticket and you're flying, you're down for anything.
As long as they keep it flowing.
Yeah.
And I guess women, it's like eating buffalo wings. You eat toe wings, you know.
Yeah, it may be too hot for you, but you'll have it anyway.
But you have it in pickled toe.
Well, I mean, hey, you know, we eat all these dead animals. Why not eat dead humans?
Say, to me,
why not drink dead humans?
I associate with pig feet.
I don't really want to eat the worm. You know that worm? I don't want to eat that either.
Oh, yeah, man. Listen, I'll swallow the worm because I've been trained to swallow a lot of things. So I'll swallow the worm, no problem.
A certain aspect of your fan base is happy to know that.
Dude, that's a line from Criminal Velocity when Charlie Sheen says that to...
From Terminal Velocity.
Terminal Velocity, Natasha Kinski.
Somebody's been eating way too much toe.
That's a line from Cobra. Oh, wait. No, wait. There's a Tango... Oh, wait. Maybe it's Tango and Cash.
Wait, listen.
Elena's got it right. Somebody's been eating too much toe.
Too much toe in the room.
Yes. I like that. Thank you for playing that. That was exceptional. Okay, Albuquerque residents claim giant owls are eating their pets.
Giant owls?
Giant owls, Mike. Giant owls, y'all. There's some stuff going on. A large owl is said to have feasted on small cats and dogs in the city. This is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It is unknown whether there are more than one of the large owls, which are said to roam the area looking for small animals to feast on. Pet owners living in the foothills are now concerned and are keeping a close eye on their beloved pooches and cats. We've seen him 3 or 4 times. He's huge. One day when we were walking, he
sounds like a date I had.
Down over my husband's head. He's a large owl, said local resident Cindy Hummel.
He's huge.
He's huge. One dog owner said she found the claw marks on the back of her pet, and another said that an owl that lives next to her home killed her puppy.
No! Yeah. This is a horrible story.
Killed her puppy, yo! Now, Marie
Owls.
Iverson. Yes. Marie Iverson.
Killer.
It's a reworking of the birds.
Yes, absolutely. The big birds.
Owls.
The big birds. Marie Iverson.
They're watching you.
Described how she heard her dog yelping. And
aww.
When she went out to see what had happened,
there was Barbara Hershey.
The puppy had disappeared.
Owls.
The puppy actually disappeared, yo.
They never sleep.
Now, the head zookeeper at the Rio Grande Zoo in Albuquerque spoke to local stations, News 13, and told them that because owls are night hunters,
owls,
it should be a good
they
idea.
They live for 400 years.
Keep your pets in the dark. So keep your pets in the dark, yo.
Keep your pets in the dark. Why? Like if the owl sees it out, they're like,
owls can't
see it. It's going to come swoop in. And those claw marks were like, it tried to pick up the dog, but it was too heavy.
Ate the puppy.
Damn, ate the puppy.
Ate the puppy.
Damn, owls.
To take those headlocks.
You know what's happening? It's because we've encroached upon their habitat.
Could it possibly be that these owls are mutant owls?
Owls.
Are these mutant owls?
No, this is one,
like, you remember that movie,
now,
something, Attack of the Animals or something
on,
like that?
Let's talk about
where the animals revolted because of what we're doing to the environment.
Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now, where's Area 51?
You think maybe the aliens? The aliens are helping. The aliens are helping the animals revolt that the animals can take over because the animals actually have more closer DNA wise to the aliens.
I think we should get a grant to see if we
Animal can Planet
figure this one out.
You know, Mike, you're starting to talk like
research
Shatner there.
We should research this, Captain.
The animals are taking over. This is one episode of $6 Million Man, and William Shatner is on it. And he goes up into space. He's an astronaut. He plays an astronaut. And he comes back after he's been in space. He can hear the dolphins. Oh, Steve! They're talking to me. They're talking to mathematics. I can hear them. And it's what's funny about the episode is because Shatner overacts so much. He's like, oh, Steve! You know, and Lee Majors underacts so much. He's like, well, I don't hear it.
I don't even know what you're doing.
I don't hear anything. That's his, like, his response is, hey, there's nothing going on. He's like, no, I hear them. They're all around me. It's a great episode. And he's got, like, his brunette wig at that point. It was the 70s.
Devastated that he actually wears a piece.
He's been wearing a piece for, like, 40 years. He was thinning on Star Trek. I think he started wearing the hairpiece then.
Yeah, he was wearing a hairpiece because they were talking about that.
But by second season, like, I think one season, like, he lost his hair or something like that. Something
overwhelming.
That. Byron.
Speak to me, Almighty Mike.
I have a couple stories.
I know you do. Now, that owl story was pretty incredible.
Pretty incredible.
Okay? We're talking pterodactyl owls. Eating puppies.
Did I ever tell you my pterodactyl story?
No.
Yes, I did.
You sure?
Okay, I was working for Random House, okay? Yes. And at the time, I was adapting an Arthur C. Clarke novel, okay? An audiobook, you know? And so I'm really into it, you know? And I got Alfre Woodard as my star, you know what I'm saying?
Wow.
And so I flew out to L.A., directed her, you know, for 3 days in the studio, blah, blah, blah. And I'm producing it, and I'm doing the music, I'm doing the sound effects, everything. And so you got to submit, like, all your effects, your music cues, whatever. You got to submit for, you know, and the people
You're not
who are
talking about Robot City, are you?
No, this is not Robot City. This is Rama 2.
Oh,
Rama 2, that's right.
Sarah Rama 2. And so you got to submit all your music and everything. And the people who get hired for these sort of editor positions, you know, they went to some literary school or whatever, and they're there, and now they're in charge of audiobooks or whatever. And, you know, and I had one person who was like the top person, and then she had somebody right under her who was, you know, fresh out of college, whatever, 5 years. And I'll never forget the experience. So I submit my stuff, and, you know, again, I'm a veteran here, you know, and I have the Delco Award-winning sound designer. And so I submit to her, like, my pterodactyl sounds. And I had gone out, I took bird sounds, and I slowed them down, you know, the echo and everything. And you know, and I saw Johnny Quest, you know what I'm saying? And so I submit them, and she comes back to me and says, they don't sound like pterodactyls to her. And I'm like, you know, why don't you show me your pterodactyl sound? Yeah, so, you know, so I had to go over her head to her boss and submit them to her boss. And the boss is like, they're fine. What are you talking about? So anyway, just my pterodactyl. Sorry. I've told you that story. You just remember it now.
Yes,
you
never remember
it. You're remembering it as
yeah,
I told
so
you.
So basically it was like, excuse me.
I can see why you didn't remember it initially.
Excuse me, Mr. Sergeant, but this does not sound like a pterodactyl. Pterodactyls don't sound like a shield that sound like.
Pterodactyls clearly don't sound like that.
Yes.
So you went over her head, too.
Yes, I did. All right, how about this? Fantastic Voyage Probe detects dangerous blood clots. Now, check this out, Bart. Tell me this is not science fiction and Raquel Welch.
Wait a minute.
What?
The little people, they
Yes, listen. Listen to me. Yes, they did. The movie Fantastic Voyage had a miniature submarine sent into a VIP's bloodstream to destroy a life-threatening clot. A new probe is hot on the fictional micro-sub's tail fins. It can pass through arteries to spot the most dangerous clots and deposits. Existing probes are essentially cameras that can travel inside arteries. Doctors must spot deposits and judge whether they are likely to come loose and block an artery. The new probe, developed by Guillermo Tierney at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, also detects molecules that mark out the most harmful clots and fatty plaques. To test the probe, Tierney's team first fed rabbits a diet of generated arterial deposits. Oh! Like, yeah. That sentence right there. Okay, let me read that sentence again. Tierney's team first fed rabbits a diet of generated arterial deposits. Then they injected them with a fluorescent chemical that tags the danger sign molecules. The probe carries a detector to the fluorescent light, which revealed bright areas on artery walls where the tags had found their targets. The team were able to detect fibrin. That's a protein that causes clots to form. And cathepsin B, an enzyme found in most dangerous plaques. In principle, any molecule could be detected, including molecular signatures of cancer, said Tierney. And just like on the submarine, lasers zap suspicious lesions that could be added. Although it would require further development to possibly combine therapy with the probe to combat dangerous plaques. Detecting fibrin could easily be valuable for people who have arterial blockages that open through the surgical fitting of stents. Often, I'm going to emphasize that word, because you know how often they use stents. It says, often these rapidly become reblocked, and the first sign that this is happening is the deposition of fibrin on the stent. Existing probes cannot distinguish fibrin from healthy deposits, such as cells that line the stent. The fluorescent tests can, so doctors can give clot-busting drugs before blockages can form. Tierney now intends to test the device in people undergoing surgery for coronary artery disease.
So we got the little microbes ready to go after and attack the big microbes.
Donald Pleasant.
Secret kind of like...
pulling...
the little people.
White corpuscles
they're
from Raquel
Welch. They're in the little atoms. They're down there doing their thing.
That's right.
I've got to get out of here.
You ever see that movie?
Can they train them to, like, just shoot fat?
All right, listen, I'm going to go to my interview.
You know, before you did that, there was a movie on today with Frank Sinatra and Raquel Welch.
Yeah.
Frank just stood there and just... the whole time.
Yo, Kang.
He looked at Raquel. What did he say?
I'm like, he's actually sitting below Raquel. She comes in, she's like,
how you doing? You want a drink? And he's like, well, not right now. She says, okay. And she drinks his drink and her drink. She's like, nah, I feel better.
Just prank the doctor, Mikael Welch. Just so stupid from the...
Yo, Kane. Your time is up.
Linda, you had something you wanted to say?
Is Byron is up. What was Byron talking about?
He doesn't know.
Yes.
You know what Byron's talking about?
If you could send these little lasers, can they, like,
yo,
shoot
Kane,
fat deposits?
Time is up.
Essentially, yes.
You so, got it. You got it. Thank
that's
you.
Better than exercise.
Yo, Kane. Kane. Yo, Kane. Your time is up.
You're tuned to listener sponsored radio, WBAI. I'm speaking with Jose Padilla, who is the writer-director of the new film Elite Squad, The Enemy Within. Jose, welcome to WBAI.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Mike.
Looking at your background as both a documentary filmmaker and then moving on to being a narrative filmmaker, what, having done documentaries, were you able to bring to doing narrative film that maybe you wouldn't have had the same perspective or style if you hadn't done that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's a great question because I do see myself as a documentary filmmaker making a couple of fictional movies. I am a documentary filmmaker first and foremost for several reasons, but the main one is that I'm very interested in films that reflect reality.
Yes.
And you know, although fiction is very different from documentary in the process of shooting a movie, I do feel that there is something very similar. And that's my usual comparison is, I think that shooting a documentary is similar to writing a screenplay. That's where I think the similarity lies, at least on my method of shooting. Because, you know, when you're shooting a documentary, you're sort of like searching for a story with a camera. And depending on what you get, you know, the footage you get in doc, you sort of like, you know, change what you're going to film next so you can come up with, at the end, hopefully with a good narrative, you know, a good narration of the doc that you're doing. And that's what you do when you write the screenplay based on reality. You know, you research the reality that you're going to portray in your fictional film, you write, you learn some more, you change what you write. So I feel that's the similarity between shooting a documentary and writing a screenplay if your film is reality-based.
Well, you know, actually, that's a very, very fascinating answer because one of the reasons I loved your movie is this is the kind of film I like where it's definitely entertaining, it's definitely engaging, but you're learning. You're learning about the culture, you're learning about the politics, and it clearly smacks of reality. And, you know, the knowledge I have of Rio de Janeiro's history let me know that you definitely did your research. So I'm curious, when you're crafting a film, especially something narrative like this, what inspires you first with Elite Squad? Because now this is the sequel to another film. What came first, the idea, the background? How does it all come together for you? What's your process?
Right. It all started 2 movies ago with a documentary that I directed called Ocean 74. And it's a crazy story because, you know, I was in my gym running in a treadmill, and the television started to broadcast this live footage of a guy who had hijacked the bus and kept the people inside as hostages, and the police surrounded the bus. And I made a whole story, a whole documentary about that event in Rio, which ended tragically, actually. In order to do that documentary, I interviewed several policemen. And when I interviewed the policemen, I understood that there was a deeper story lurking behind that hijack, which is the way policemen live in Rio. And it's a crazy police we have. You know, just to put things on perspective, in the United States, every year, the police kills about 200 to 240 people that resist arrest. And the U.S. has about 300 million inhabitants. In Rio, which is a city that has 7 million, every year the police kills about 1,000 people.
Wow.
This gives you an idea of how violent police is. And so when I got together and I started interviewing those guys, and they were like talking very nicely, politely, calmly to me, and I was hearing, you know, it was a great contrast between what they were, the way they looked and they talked, and what they were actually saying.
you know, the amount of violence and torture and everything that they did in their day-to-day basis. And that set me off to do research on the police, to make the first movie, which is pretty much about how the police works, on you know, I've seen from inside the police. And then to do the Elite Squad, the Enemy Between, which is about what makes the police be so distorted and so violent and corrupt in Rio, and that's when I get into the politics of everything. So it, truly, to me, it was like a, you know, traveling between films. One film led to another film, which led to another film.
Huh. Well, it makes a lot of sense, and what I really enjoyed, again, in your film was, it's a very complex issue. You know, you want to get rid of the quote-unquote scumbags, as they say in the film, but at the same time, do you avoid human rights? Do you, where do you draw the line as to how to handle it? And based on, like, some of the characters, without giving away the story, based on their training, they're going to react in a certain way, no matter what the situation is, even if things have changed slightly.
Yes, I think you're right. And actually, what you've said in the context of Elite Squad, it's true in every single context. You know, social structures, organizations have a huge impact on the way people behave.
Right.
You know, and so depending on how the police is set up, because of the way the police is set up in Rio, we do have a lot of policemen torturing and being corrupt. A huge number of them. But, you know, it's the same thing, let's say, depending on how a certain battalion in an army is set up, you may end up having war crimes. Depending on, you know, it's a true thing that the way organizations treat their individuals have a very big impact on how they behave on an average. And this is sort of like what Elite Squad, the Enemy, would you know, it takes a look at how the police is structured in Rio. It also asks, why is the police structured? And so it takes away a look at how the politicians get elected in Rio and how they use the police to get votes, basically, and what the process they do to get those votes from manipulating the police. And basically what they're doing is they're taking control of slums, of, you know, communities where people have very little money, but they vote. And they are using the power they have through the police over those communities to make them vote for them. That's the bottom line, that's what it is.
Like you said, the situation is the same, I think, all over the world. And part of it has to do with, once you are living a certain way, could say in New York, for instance, it's not as bad as it was at one time, but there are lots of homeless, there are lots of people begging. And after a while, you kind of become numb to human suffering. You'll walk right past someone who's ill or sick or a mother with a child or whatever, because you become desensitized. And I have to imagine, being a policeman, after a while, human beings being as tribal as they are, there's an us and them. So you can't help but see anybody who's doing wrong as being less than you.
I think you are absolutely correct. And it's not only, it's this thing that we're talking about, you know, getting sensitized, it's a human.
Yes, it is.
It's human beings that are capable of getting desensitized. And not only policemen, but also doctors, for instance.
Definitely.
You know, it happens. And what that tells us, truly, is that, you know, you can look at individual cases. For instance, you can look at a policeman who's been violent, and you can put this policeman in trial, and you shoot, by the way, and you can, you know, you can decide, a jury can decide its fate. But that's looking at it from a limited standpoint, because if the number of policemen who are being violent is very big, you have to look at the organization that's breeding that violence. You have to look at the police at itself. That's the only way you can change the behavior of policemen, is changing the way the police is structured. And the
I agree with you 1,000%.
Listen, it happened in New York, you know. Even for me as a foreigner, you know, I come to New York all the time, and back in the, you know, back in the 80s, the police was not like it was today.
No.
In New York, it has improved. That's the sort of the sense that I have. You know, there's less violence, and it's safe to work.
in Central Park at night, and a lot of this, I think, has to do with the way the police changed.
Well, and it's good and bad, and there are two sides to it. You know, as a person of color myself living here in New York, we have a lot of serious issues of our own within the police force, from racial profiling to even what's going on down at Occupy Wall Street now, where you have all these reports of police brutality. And I think it's, like you said, I think it would take a complete restructure of how not only do we train our policemen, what kind of people we pick, what kind of care they're going to get to keep them sane, in a way. Because I kind of believe that after a while, there's a great line in your movie where the character is testifying and he says, I've done a lot of killing and I can't completely say, you know, who for or what was the right way, but it's something he's done. It's something he, at the time when he did it, he thought was the thing to do.
Yeah, that's it's a great thing you pick up that line because it summarizes the movie.
Yes, it does.
Just after he says that, he adds, but I know I didn't pull the trigger by myself.
By myself, exactly.
Yeah. And that's sort of like the point we are both, trying to make here, which is you got to look at the institution.
That's right.
You talked about, racial profiling in the police. It's undeniable that there is racial profiling in the police in mm-hmm. the U.S. It's almost when I see people arguing that there is no racial profiling in the police in the U.S., I think they are out of their minds.
Towards the end of the film, the sequence of events in the films are being spun a certain way to the public. That's a lot of what it is. And I have to say, this point really came across. People talk about democracy. What's wrong with democracy? What's wrong with democracy is democracy. It's not the fact that everybody can vote, but it's the fact that what influences those people's vote and who has the power to influence that vote.
Yes, absolutely. You know, democracy only works when the power structure is not having a huge influence in the outcome of elections.
Right. And that has yet to happen in any country, as far as I'm concerned.
That has yet to happen.
On Earth.
I totally agree. Control of the media. Listen, the media in Brazil is as biased as the media here, which is very biased. So to speak, television, and it's even funny because there's one thing I gotta say which strikes me as a foreigner as being funny when I look at television in the U.S., which is the moment you put it on a TV channel, you put it on Fox television or you put it on MSNBC, and you know exactly what the political agenda of that specific...
Oh, for sure.
Instantaneously.
For sure.
No attempt to hide it. It's funny.
Well, I find it's the same way in the newspaper. You read an article, it'll start out, it's so not news, it's completely biased. They start out by, if they're talking about a candidate or a person in the news, they start out by practically insulting them or making up a nickname or something derogatory. How can it be how is it even considered journalism if it's already telling you what's wrong?
It's true. And, in my movie, I have a character that's sort of like the Rio de Janeiro Fox.
I love it. I love him.
Which he is actually interested in the political outcome of the way the police is managed. And he uses the television to shape the opinion. Yeah. And in a certain sense, when I look at the structure of my movie and the different social, entities that are interacting to create the state of affairs you see, there are some similarities regarding what goes on in the U.S.
The similarities were painfully clear to me. Now that also brings me to another question, and which I also thought is interesting about your film. Now, I happen to believe that film is an incredibly powerful medium for conveying information, story, for even changing people's perspective on things it can do.
I agree.
And I think it says something that this film, whereas we live in a world where people prefer, generally, the movies that make the most money are movies that are fantasy or science fiction or have very little to do with reality, whereas the most money-making film in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, prior to this was Avatar, now it's your film. What do you think it says that people, do you feel people are hungry to get some answers? Because I think your film not only portrays it, but it also gives you an understanding of how things are the way they are.
Here is the thing, my movie is totally independent. It was produced independently, and it was distributed independently. I literally distributed this movie out of my garage, which is insane, because we opened to, you know, 1,000 screens, and then we crossed $70 million, which is totally insane, right?
Yep.
But, and then, so people look at this in Brazil and they say, how could that happen? And the reason is, because it's an independent film, we can say whatever we want.
Yep.
You see, there's no sort of like damage political control from whatever organization that would be, you know, big organization or big media or studio thing that depends on the government to make their living. And so they have those films that are made by those huge organizations have a way of, you know, stopping criticism at a certain level.
Mm.
You know? And I think truly they are hurting their own business, because look at what happens when you say what people really know to be the truth, and you put it out there, and then people go and watch it. So I think that in this country, for instance, if a big studio made a very, very political, aggressive movie, I think the movie would be a blockbuster. You see, but they don't make it because they can't. You know, all the business relations.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. You remind me a little bit. I don't know if you're familiar with the filmmaker Toporovsky.
Which one?
He's dead now. Sergei Toporovsky was a Russian filmmaker.
Oh, yes, of course.
And
That's a great compliment.
Well, he was just making films that had things to say about the culture he came from, that the culture he came from, and the powers that be did not want him to make.
Absolutely.
So, and now, again, like I said, I mentioned to you, I'm a filmmaker, and so I kind of come from the school also of believing that a film is directed three times. The first time when you write it, you know, you're directing it in your head. Second time when you're on set, and the third time when you're in editing. My question to you is, A, do you agree with this, and B, what is your favorite part, considering your background? And what do you get out of each?
Well, listen, I agree with you. I mean, a film goes clearly through three different stages, in which it can totally change, by the way. Number one is when you write it, two is when you shoot it, and finally when you edit it. Absolutely. I mean, for me, I love writing. I love, if we're talking about documentaries, the phase that I like the most is that I'm shooting it. If we're talking about a fictional movie, you know, I love the process of research, writing, and also preparing the actors. You know, my movies, you know, I spend a lot of time working with the actors, like 2 to 3 months. I bring in policemen, I bring real life, you know, drug dealers, and so I train with the actors the actual environment where the film takes place. And so this process of, you know, researching, writing, and training with the actors, it actually changes the screenplay a lot. Because I get a lot of input from the actors who are living, you know, the experience of, you know, being a Bobby Cop, going up in the slum with Bobby Cops, and actually doing those things in real life. And so the way that I write, because I write as I do that, it's very important for my films, for shaping.
Do you have different parts of each stage that you like, or is writing definitely clearly your favorite part?
Listen, I love shooting, actually. Editing is clearly, for me, every single movie I've done, editing has a very clear progress. It starts with, you know, the assemble in which we are depressed, right? We assemble the movie for the first time, we look at it, we get depressed. And then we start editing it.
Right.
We go from being depressed to being happier and happier and happier.
Right.
And if we wrote the thing right, and if we shot it right, then at the end of the editing thing, we are very, very happier than we open the movie, you know?
Sure.
So editing is like, for me, it's like, you know, going down into the dark stages of where we really have this film.
Right, right.
And then, you know, seeing the light.
Well, it's almost, to me, I find it almost like sculpture, because you're just refining and refining and refining till finally, look, there's the Adonis, you know?
Yeah, no, Wood Allen is famous for having said, you know, there's no such thing as a good first cut.
That's very true. Very true. All right, well, I have a few more questions. They're not giving you a signal, are they yet?
Yes, they are, actually.
Oh, okay. All right, well, I guess my last question to you is, I think you're an amazing choice for RoboCop. Are you going to take a similar approach in terms of projecting how things can be in your storyline?
Yes, exactly. I mean, RoboCop is a very interesting film for me because, one, it has a huge potential for social criticism.
Definitely.
And two, it talks about something that's going to become more and more common in our lives, which is technology replacing body parts. Given technology replacing or making things that the brain is supposed to do. So it sort of talks about what's called the mind-body problem in philosophy, which is, you know, how come that we have a consciousness? Can machines be conscious? And so on. And so just the concept of RoboCop and what it can allow you to do as a filmmaker, it's fantastic. That's why I took on this film.
Well, I also think along with one of the themes in your films so far that I've seen is the idea of, like you said, when do you also lose your humanity? When do you become a machine? When are you a killing machine if killing means nothing to you? When do you regain it?
That's exactly what RoboCop is going to be about.
Okay.
Got it.
Well, I love your work, man, and I'm down. I hope I get to talk to you again. I'd love to stay in touch.
So do I.
May have heard a lot of jam sessions blown off. You may have heard a New Orleans fit. You may have heard a Chicago stop. You may have heard of all kinds of jazz. Jumping the wildest and the most insane.
You may have heard of Byron Saunders.
Yo, Mike. Staying right with you.
Are you staying right with me? Elena, are you still here?
I'm still here.
Elena, you know, do you just adhere to the whole less is more kind of concept?
Yes, in terms of clothing.
Well,
absolutely.
Just in terms of time here on the air. Chris?
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say to people?
I just wanted, like, so did you and the director go on a date? Because, like, it's obvious you guys bonded beyond the planet.
It was a love fest.
Yeah, it was beyond a love fest. Yeah. It was like, and then Mike says, well, am I going to see you again? Because, like, we're just having a great time. Like, are they signaling you? Because
he was your donkey.
No, yeah. But he was, I really liked the film. It was really good.
No, I know. It was a great interview, and I just hope that you two guys have a love fest, because it was obvious that you connected beyond anything. I mean, everything you said, he was like, Mike, I can't believe you said that, Mike.
Yes. Did either of you have tiramisu afterwards?
Yeah, we had tiramisu right after the interview.
Great interview.
Thank you. You're tuned to Listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. This is Night Shift. And you can visit us on the web at lifeislikesciencefiction.com. That's all one word, Life is Like Science Fiction. You can email us at lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com,
very
all
true.
One word.
Very, very
and
true.
And you can like us on Facebook.
We want to hear from you.
NITESHIFT.
Night Shift.
Night Shift.
It's my
on
favorite
Facebook.
Show. Yeah.
And what's coming up next, Max?
Max, what's up?
What's coming up?
Oh, no.
Oh, Jimmy Dore.
Jimmy.
Until next week. You can even leave us a voicemail at 209-29.
Just post. Just emails. We'd like to hear from you.
25.
Yeah. What a great show, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Night Shift.
Bye.
Night Shift.
Big Band Jones.